I'm just going to put this here.
There's a great Yiddish tradition of let me say a few words before I speak. When I use it as a joke, it's fun because different crowds get the joke at different rates. The opportunity to bring Torah into our community that the Kollel does is so valuable and reverberates in all sorts of ways. What's powerful about this first, and I hope annual, CLE around ethics is it gets to the essence of what our legal system comes from. When you study Torah and Talmud, and if you're a lawyer, you see the connections. This system that we have, the American legal system, the common law system that England did, is built on texts that we look for guidance and meaning from through dialogue and discourse. And there's a great spirit behind this, which is captured by a following story. A rabbi comes home, says to his wife, I studied this tractate of Talmud. We read, one rabbi says we do one thing, light the Hanukkah candles left to right. Another rabbi says do another thing, light the candles left to right to left. And in the end, they're both right. To which his wife says, honey, they both can't be right. And he says, you're right too. And so struggling with these core concepts in a spiritually meaningful way is essential to being a human being, to being an effective lawyer, to being a Jew. And that's something that we have the benefit of this tradition, and the Kollel brings it to us in a deeper, richer, powerful way with such incredible leaders. So I am one of the people who are doing the Live On. And when I was just telling Rabbi Schwab, when I did our recent will and we included a gift to the Kollel, we actually brought our kids along. And we went to a law firm as we got all the signatures, and they said something that was very meaningful, which is, shouldn't you do something more meaningful in your will, like give money to the kids to give to tzedakah, or leave them with some books that are meaningful to you that they can carry on? And so shouldn't the will itself, it has a legal purpose, but it should also have a spiritual purpose. And I thought that was a pretty profound point, because we have just done a fairly bare bones will at this point, which commercial advertisement, please at least do that. When I was getting our will signed from a friend of mine, I won't know him, but you know who I'm talking about, he said, and he's got kids, oh, I don't have a will, right? This is like the cobbler with no shoes. So please get a will, and in your will, put money for the Kollel and or other groups that can benefit from your generosity. So this topic here is one that, as a former law school dean, we have this in common being a dean, I recognize we have not done justice by. There's not enough discussion about how lawyers talk to clients. I've got one of our grads here, right? That's not something we taught a lot of law school. But yet, if you talk to lawyers about what matters to them, how they talk to their clients is actually one of the most important things you have to do as a lawyer. But often there's not enough training. And it is a ethically either elevating and or fraught area. Because one of the jobs of lawyers, and the topic of our conversation, is how do you tell your client what they need to hear rather than potentially telling them what they want to hear, or worse yet, what you want them to hear. And this is a point that we want to reflect on. And we've had a prior discussion, and I have the benefit now of getting some Torah wisdom into discussion. So with that frame, how would you want to add and start off?
Thank you, Phil. I just want to say that Phil just told me this about his discussion with his children. I think that speaks volumes to the way Phil and his wife are raising their children, and should have a lot of nachas from them. thank you. Actually, thank you, Phil. If I could make a quick mention of thanks to our Attorney General, who's a prestigious job, but a little bit more prestigious than that is the fact that he's the founder of this program. Okay, 15 years ago.
So my daughter, who said that when she was in her, car seat, what happened was the Kollel brought someone who they thought was this great learned rabbi. Said, we had this great program. And I said, you're great learned rabbis. You could have a series on topics relevant to people. I didn't name it Torf Tycoons, by the way, so if you like it or hate it, not me. I said, you should be bringing your wisdom to our community, and I think I might have suggested this might be a format that would do that. So I also give my daughter credit, who was there, and that she's 15, so that was 15 years ago this program was launched.
Okay, so let's start from giving some of a few pointers on giving advice and direction to our clients. So as attorneys, we are engaged. I'm not an attorney. I'm sorry. You are engaged in a contract to give advice and direction, which is to the best interest of your client. So giving outright. Let's start from this. Giving outright bad advice to somebody is simply unethical, and it's also going to be transgressing a directive from the Torah.
But let's for a minute pause here. And by the way, if anyone wants to jump in with questions or thoughts, please, let's keep this interactive. Bad advice is a lot easier to give than it sounds. Because when you say give bad advice, it's wrong. It sounds like you're doing something that's willful. But the real risk is you are convinced either by implicit biases or potentially by, let's put this, your self-interest that diverges from your client interest. So, for example, whether to litigate a case or not. You might convince yourself we've got a good shot because you failed to step back from the situation and have a fair-minded assessment of what the risk really is. Because you know that if you litigate it, you're going to make a lot more money. And this is where what the client wants to hear and what you want to what you want to say could be different than what the client needs to hear. Because you might want to say, it'll be great for me to litigate the case. It's going to be a lot of money. The client may say, oh yeah, I'm angry. I want to litigate the case. So there's this two-prong emotional pressure. And part of the challenge is, can you remove yourself and keep this moral injunction in mind so that you're playing a different game, a longer game, if you will.
So if you take a look at source number one on the first page of your booklet, that's the sources for this session. Source number one, you shall not place a stumbling block before the blind. So it's a well-known verse. And in addition to the simple understanding, the literal understanding, there is a sage. Our sages teach us this applies to other cases as well. And take a look at source number two. This is the Sifra. It says as follows. Give not a person who was blind in a manner. In some way, he's blind. He's clueless about a situation. He doesn't see correctly. And he's blind in that matter. So we should not give him advice, which is improper for him. So here's the example, which really correlates to what Phil was saying, is pertains to litigating a case. Do not say to him, sell your field and buy from the proceeds of the sale a donkey. In other words, you're giving him advice, say, sell this field. And you know what? It's a good idea. You should buy a donkey. That's a good advice. In the meantime, it's terrible advice for him for some reason. In context, we are understanding that it's bad advice. And here it adds that extra layer that you're doing it with your hidden agenda, which is the fact being that you're endeavoring to circumvent him and take the field from him. You're interested in real estate. You tell a client, or for that matter, anybody, you tell them, sell your field and go buy some livestock with it. Good financial advice. In the meantime, you have a hidden agenda. So this is actually transgressing a directive from the Torah, which is don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind.
Let me just mention one element here, because this is an ethics CLE, so an ethical commercial advertisement. If and when you have your own business interest related to what your client's doing, you need a voice in your head, and the voice that I would suggest is that from the TV show Lost in Space, where there was a robot who said, danger, Will Robinson, danger. And part of the problem here, and this stumbling block in front of the blind is so powerful when you study it, because it's not, a stumbling block in front of the blind is not necessarily a literal thing. It's a blind spot. So don't think blind, think blind spot. If you or your client have a blind spot, you are at risk for tripping over, or your client's at risk of tripping over a stumbling block. And one other teaching you often get is, what's the word from God for the sake of heaven, and what's from, call it, Satan, or the evil inclination. You will have to be better at separating those voices, because you can convince yourself of a lot of things. So the challenge you have to have is, how do you build in those other voices? One incredibly powerful tool is to be in dialogue. So it's a huge risk to practice law by yourself when you make decisions by yourself and you don't have someone to bounce something off of and say, I'm thinking about investing in my client's business. Is that an okay thing to do? Is there a risk that I could face legally, ethically? Because as a legal matter, you can disclose conflict of interests. Clients can waive conflicts. You can do these things. But you have to make sure, when you do things that are at all fraught or delicate, advising to do litigation if you know you're going to make more money, ask yourself, am I giving this advice from the right spirit in the right way? Or do I have a blind spot, or am I taking advantage of my client's blind spot?
You don't want to meet the AG in a different context. So he's giving him some good advice here. Okay, so outright bad advice, you know, this would be the starting point. But it gets more nuanced than that, obviously. So what about withholding advice? What about if, excuse me, I've been asked for advice. How about just keeping quiet? What about this? What about being like a slippery fish, you know? Like just getting out of it, right? So, you know, sometimes we're tempted to like give answers that kind of like can be understood in both ways, you know? So we cleared ourselves. So here, I'm going to read you some things I saw over here. So guy asks you for advice about a potential partner and a potential employee. So you tell him, you'd be lucky to get this work and to work this person to work for you. That can mean two things, right? You'd be lucky to get this person to work, right? I cannot recommend this person too highly, right? You're slipping out of that one. I recommend this candidate with no qualifications whatsoever. She made an immeasurable contribution to our firm. Nobody's better than this man. Okay, you get the idea. So how about just like slipping out of the list goes on. How about just slipping out of the situation and not giving advice when we indeed need to? So, of course, if your contract, if you're an in-house counsel or whatever the case is, if your contract requires you to do that, so you may be required by U.S. law and by halacha. But let's take this a step further. Even if we're not under contract, we not under an illegal agreement, the Torah here is going to be different than our cultural, it's going to be countercultural. You know, the culture of Western civilization has a very, very, very strongly built assumption that live and let live. However, we're going to see the Torah is going to come from a different direction over here. The Torah tells us in a number of ways that we are actually supposed to get involved and to say things as they are to the people around us and to get to become involved. And this doesn't necessarily apply to those who are under legal contract to give advice. Some people here are not lawyers, and everybody's welcome to this as well. And this applies in our personal ethics as well. To actually get involved and to help people get beyond their blind spots. So let's take a look at source number 3. You shall not hate your fellow in your heart. Reprove your fellow, but incur no guilt because of him. There's 3 parts to this very important verse in Vayikra and Leviticus. We're going to focus on the middle part of it. Reprove your fellow. So which means there's a positive commandment in the Torah to rebuke or to say it as it is to guide somebody to go in the right direction. So there are times that, so this is a positive command to get involved and to help somebody turn around. I was sharing with Phil the other day in the Colorado offices that there's this idea of turning somebody around, the right and the left. It's drawing close with the right hand and pushing away with the left hand. And what happens is, when you pull close and you push at the same time, is you turn them around. So that's the idea of getting involved in giving proper advice. So there is a positive command, and there is actually going to be a negative as well. Take a look at source number 4. L'samad al davreyacha. Do not stand by the blood of your fellow. Okay? So literally it means when somebody is being damaged, hurt, murdered, don't sit on your hands. Get involved and save the victim. And it's a negative command. Don't sit by and watch this happen. So while this is a dispute amongst the earlier commentaries, the Chafetz Chaim, and there's a great, a strong opinion that says that this also includes financial loss. Not only loss of blood, you know, of limb, of life and limb, but it also includes financial loss. So if I am going to sit by and not give advice when it can save somebody from a physical damage or even a financial loss, I would be transgressing, so to speak, this negative commandment.
So this has a powerful social justice element. There's a lot of Torah teaching. So it starts with, you know, Cain and Abel, where I am not my brother's keeper. It goes to, I think Hillel says, treat your neighbor as yourself. The rest is commentary. So there's an idea that we have this social contract and this obligation. And lawyers are also given that sort of injunction to quote again Leviticus, is it Leviticus or is it justice shall you pursue?
Yeah,
is that Leviticus?
Yes.
Or okay. And the importance here is when you see something happening that's wrong, you're not free to turn away from it and say it's not my problem. You can't just let yourself off the hook. It's tempting to, again, and this is where the talking yourself out of doing something or into something is the risk. You want to say, it's not my problem, or they didn't ask me what I thought, or I'm just not going to say anything. And the teaching is no, you have to say something. And there's, a great from a social justice, great from Pirkei Avot, very fond of, which is you don't have the obligation to repair the world yourself. But you're not free to desist from doing your part. And one of the great elements of what lawyers are supposed to be in society is doing our part to repair the world. And that has a counseling element, not just pure legal advice. So, for example, if you have a client who's thinking about firing somebody, and the question is, can I get away with firing the person? But the real reason they're firing the person is because they're pregnant, which is both illegal and I would say immoral to do that. You're on very slippery ground if you're trying to either avoid saying something because you would rather ignore it, or even worse, be complicit in doing something where you're helping them avoid liability. What we're told to do is to instead say to your client, what you are thinking about doing is wrong, legally and morally. You will pay a price for it. Can we try to find a way to solve your problem without you doing something that is so ethically compromised?
So I just want to finish up on in this section. There's just one more possible negative commandment to sitting on your hands and allowing somebody to go down the wrong road and be, you know, have a blind spot. And that's source number 5. This is the concept of Hashavas Aveda. If you see your fellow's ox or sheep go astray, do not ignore it. You must return it to your fellow. This is the idea of returning a lost object to somebody who's lost something. So the sages teach us that it is also to include helping somebody not lose something in the first place. So it's not only about waiting till somebody loses something and then you gotta schlep it back to him. You gotta help him not lose in the first place. So here's another way that through proper advice, somebody could avoid a loss. And that brings us to our next section. Go ahead.
Let's go, Mikey. Yeah.
So you've been looking at this, I think, mostly through the lens of your own client. As lawyers, sometimes we run up against lawyers who are giving bad advice to their own clients, but we can't reach out directly directly to those opposing parties and say, we're going to lose a lot of money here if we keep working with this person. It seems like there's a conflict here between the ethical obligation that I have as an attorney versus what's being dictated here, where I can't keep the fellow in my heart. I can't put stumbling blocks in front of them, but by the same token, I can't just sit there and let it happen.
Well, I think your question is amazing, because if you're in two opposing parties, you know the best moves for the opposition, and you're not going to let them know that, right? And how are you going to do that?
I think the theory of the bar, which gets harder when bars get larger, is that you are situated in repeat playing games or ongoing relationships with other members of the bar. And so the theory is, at some point you have the opportunity to say to the other lawyer, I don't think you handle that the best way. You might think about handling it different. And we're going to get to the really hard question about how can you give people feedback. And the theory of the bar is that we are situated together to give each other feedback. And the risk is the following risk. If you view the world through zero-sum thinking, there's only a certain number of clients out there, we're all fighting over clients, you're setting yourself up for a much more uncomfortable dynamic. The leap of faith that I would commend to everybody is, don't view the world through a zero-sum lens, win-lose. View the world through a win-win lens, which is, we can all thrive together. And part of that alternative view is, it liberates you to see things and differently, which is, it may not be conventional to think, wait a minute, why are you trying to help your opposing counsel become a better lawyer? And the answer is, if you're playing a longer game where you're thinking, my goal is to operate with integrity, with an ethic of caring about others, and I believe it will come back to me, I will say, that is indeed how I view the world. I recognize others might take a different view, which is, no, I want to cut every corner, work every angle, grab every dollar on the table, because that will be better for me. My view is, well, let's see how that works out in the long run.
You're just bringing up, you're just bringing up a very important question. Now, within the context of a bar and a system, you need to defend your client, and the opposing, party's got to have their own defending, attorneys and everything else. But really, if we be honest with ourselves, this is something to grapple with outside of a legal, construct. And interpersonal, it's when I'm saving one person, I may be hurting another. And the question is here, where does this apply? And that's a whole other conversation. I think you're really tapping onto an important piece of it. You had a question?
Yeah, my question is, to what extent do you need to give that advice? There's a lot of people we encounter, I'm a paralegal, but for the attorney to speak with their client or for opposing counsel, they're very stubborn, or they think they're right. And, at what point, legally and Torah-wise, do you have to kind of toe that line?
Now, explain to me again the situation. This is where you're an observer.
As an observer, or, for the attorney that I work for, in which case, you constantly have clients who call up and ask for advice that they don't want to hear.
Right.
Or you're talking to opposing counsel who's seeking a bad legal outcome, and you're, at what point then do you...
I think I hear your question on a number of levels. Let me start, and then if I miss some, let me know. One level here, which is super powerful point, and this is great because we hadn't put it, you're often working in a context where you may see someone you're working with, say you're an associate, it's a partner, or a paralegal, and you see them doing things that we're talking about here as a mistake. What do you do in that situation? So we're going to get to the really hard and important is, how can you give feedback so they might hear? You've already anticipated that by saying, what if the person has a lot of arrogance, so they don't necessarily welcome or want feedback? They think they know it all. What I would say then is the following. All of us have the challenge from, are we working in an organization with an ethical culture that we can feel good about and that we're our best authentic selves? And I recognize many people don't have the luxury of saying absolutely in every way. So some people say, yeah, I worry that I'm working in an organization that is somewhat sexist, that women aren't given an opportunity to succeed. Or I worry that I'm an organization where people seem to not always tell the truth. Or I worry an organization where people don't respect or value that some of us are parents and our kids have, whatever the ethical or other cultural shortcomings. What I would say then is you want to build up yourself and you want to be aware that there are other organizations out there. Before you do that, you should do what you can to improve your organization by doing your best. But that ultimately, there's a way to think about the world from the lens of exit, voice, and loyalty. If the organization has earned more of your loyalty, you owe them more of your voice to try to improve it. If you're trying to improve it and voice doesn't seem to matter, they don't want to hear you, they're like, just shut up and do your work, you're like, okay, then you should be thinking more about exit. Did I answer your question?
I think so. What about when you have a client, let's say as an attorney, I'm not an attorney, but if you had an attorney and they were trying to give their client counsel and that client felt that they knew everything and they didn't have any, you know, they're asking advice, but they really don't want to hear it.
Let me first say another piece, which as Attorney General, I get to watch, and one of the best parts of the job. We have so many clients because we're a forced marriage with every single agency in state government. And there's a range of challenges. Sometimes the challenge is our lawyer, for whatever reason, ends up thinking or acting that they're the client. So sometimes clients will say, just tell me what to do. That's the reverse of what you just said, which is not a good situation because the client has to make critical, call it business decisions. Lawyers advise on legal risk, other considerations, but the lawyer should not be making the ultimate decision. So the lawyer acting as a client is not good. The reverse situation is the one you kind of said, which is the client thinks that they're the lawyer and they don't really want advice at all. They may not, the worst version is they don't even ask for it, think they need it, and then the lawyers are afterwards thinking, gosh, I wish you'd asked. Educating clients on how to take advice is important, and what generally, in my experience, has been failure is the best teacher. So a client fails to ask for advice at all, doesn't use us, for example, the Department of Law, something not so good happens, and then our challenge is to say, we'd really love to build a relationship in the future where you are consulting us more on the front end. We can help you get to a better outcome. And I hope experience is a good teacher because you have to look for that experience that then gives you the window to say, we want to work with you in a partnership. But for that to work, there has to be open and honest communication up front. And you may not ultimately always do what we might say, but if we're saying this is a higher risk decision, this is a lower risk decision, if you do the higher risk, here's how you might mitigate risk, then you are, again, working together. But if the client thinks they know everything, they don't need to ask the lawyer or they don't really want to listen, that's not a high-functioning relationship.
Yeah, I encounter that issue a lot. I'm a litigator, and you know, I often have situations where a client will be making business decisions that they don't understand that it's going to impact this ongoing litigation in a way that they've never thought about. And because of the kind of litigation that I deal with tends to be high-stakes litigation, I have to get in front of that. I can't wait for the client to make that mistake. And so one of the first things I do when I'm, you know, taking on a new case is I try to learn the client's business as much as I can and understand, okay, what are some inflection points that are coming up that might impact the litigation and, you know, get in front of that because...
How do you scare them so that they will know to talk to you? How do you bring that awareness to their mind?
I mean, it's, you know, you try to come up with examples, you know, depending on the business of what, you know, what kinds of things have happened. But, you try, you know, I have a case that recently where a client engaged in basically initiated another lawsuit that had negative implications for the lawsuit that we were involved in. And I think a good example going forward that I can point out to other clients and say, look, if you're going to initiate any litigation at all, you need to talk to us because this is, you know, usually the cases we're involved in are their biggest case by far. And so it's like, if you want to initiate some other litigation, fine. But if you're going to have this really important witness get deposed in that case and potentially have to deal with that, then we need to be involved and you need to get us in.
So I think our next section actually, this is an excellent segue into that. It actually brings comes circles right back to these points over here. You know, often we don't want to step in and to tell people things that they don't want to hear because we don't want to lose a relationship. You know, it's something, we don't lose a client, we don't want to lose a relationship, we don't want to do it. But we're going to focus on it from a different perspective, and we're going to see that really a true friend or a truly good counsel is one who's going to tell it as it is, even if it's painful. It's in the long run, that's really what's the true friend. If you take a look at
I will say, back to this point, we had a client that I had worked with who didn't initially use us in a delicate situation. Then we got brought in once it was not good, and I said, I think this thing probably needs to happen. And it was personnel advice embodied in legal awareness that the person was now sufficiently compromised by how they had acted, including not talking to us earlier, that I didn't think that person was going to be able to stay. The client did not want to hear that. Later down the road, the client came to realize that was the right advice and then was able to say the client was counseled right, wasn't able to initially take it, but then further appreciated. So it had the good effect of building a better relationship, but it took both not using us, not listening, and then later thinking, okay, mea culpa, I need you. And so sometimes you have to go through that cycle, and now we're in a very good place because of having gone through it.
I would also just mention that, you know, recently in my practice, I've started really focusing on my intakes and like creating what it means to create a relationship and boundaries and what kind of advice I'm going to give and when you're going to need to hear it and how I'm going to tell you the truth. And I actually now have them, not only do I have this conversation, I now actually write out a form and I sign it and I send them home with it. And sometimes it's just like, you need to communicate with us this on, you know, the third Wednesday of every month, whatever, you know, it may be. Or just to say like, these are the conversations that we're going to have that may be difficult, and this is what it's going to look like throughout. And I think that at least then when I have those conversations, I can go back and say, remember that form that we talked about at the first intake, that this is going to be really difficult. And at least then it jogs their memory and saying, oh, okay, she warned me about this, because at least then they have some preparation or something to think back on. And I really do think that's improved some of my relationships with some of my particularly difficult clients recently.
So sometimes in ethics of these, you get practice pointers. That is probably the best one we can have, which is, like my daughter particularly thought about the will, a lot of lawyers don't think hard about sort of their initial retention, you know, retainer. They have an agreement with the client. Some lawyers, words to the wise, don't do this, don't have one at all. Not a good idea. Others have it, and it's like formulaic. Then the clients don't even really need to sign it. What you said is make that intake and kind of agreement spiritually significant as part of building a relationship. And that's, I think, powerful advice.
You know, both of you guys over there, you had mentioned you take time to get to know your client's business. I think that one thing that I learned in a different career in my life is that you have to establish a rapport, and that's what you're talking about. But part of that is awkward as an attorney because your client oftentimes wants you to be an authority. Right? And they want you to have the answers. But sometimes I think that at the outset especially, you need to establish with your client that you're going to listen to them and you're going to hear what their concerns are. And then that's obviously going to make them more receptive, whether you do it through research or like sit down and do the writing. But really, you're not an authority. Like you're in service to your client. Right? I think a lot of times we, as lawyers, sometimes doctors too, you're in this position of authority and you forget you're actually in service. This is a service job, right?
The service mindset is very important. And the other thing I will say that is delicate here, it's worth acknowledging, the billable hour is a fraught ethical issue because sometimes either on the client side or on the lawyer side, it gets in the way of what we're talking about. Are you billing me for this conversation? Will be a and then again back to the longer game. I would encourage people err on the side of saying no. I am building the relationship that will pay dividends. You will make it back. by having that relationship. Do not let the billable hour get in the way. Oh, I want to learn a little about your business. Are you going to bill me for it? Like that, I would say, no. I want to get to know you so I can serve you better. Doing that sort of front-end investment work that builds relationship will pay dividends.
Excellent. So the Mesillas Yesharim, the Path of the Just, talks about this idea of explaining what a true friendship is, somebody who's actually going to say it as it is. He talks about from the other side and really applies to a lawyer-client relationship. If you take a look at source number 6, he talks about how a person should search for those friends who are going to tell him and show him where his blind spots are. Take a look at source number 6. The only good then is for a person to seek out honest friends who will enlighten his eyes in areas that he is blind, right, his blind spot, and rebuke him out of love. Important point we'll talk about later. Thus rescuing him from all evil. He can be saved by a good relationship, like we're talking about. If there's a relationship that he's looking, if a client is looking or a friend is looking and for somebody to help correct him, For what a person cannot see due to his inability to see fault in himself. We as people have blind spots. We see things through our lens, which is colored by our vested interests and our wills, right? What we'd want it to be. They will see and understand and warn him to be protected. This really encapsulates your position.
There's so much here. Yeah. It makes me want to read Path of the Just. One thing to note on this that's really powerful is the point I said earlier about the rabbi and the story of, you know, you're right too, is all truth is partial. We're never going to see everything. So this point about humility and listening gets there. And the point here is, I think, also there that you can learn by being in a trusted relationship. None of us can see everything. And that's important for the lawyer to know. You're not seeing everything. You got to really listen to your client and recognize there are things you're missing. The client needs to know you're not seeing everything. You got to really listen to the lawyer. And ideally, you just keep extending like a network, because you as a lawyer then have other friends, colleagues who you might talk to that you learn things from.
And I think that speaks to point number 7. The Path of the Just continues. The Mesillas Yesharim continues. And he says how important it is. You know, we hire all types of people in our lives. And here he speaks about the importance of hiring counsel. It's more important you have a wait staff and a catering staff and a gardener and a chauffeur and all that stuff. Most important employee of your business, your estate, your family, is somebody is going out there and making a friend that is going to be able to show you and help you through your blind spots. And let's see what it says. Therefore,
and just quick point, there's a lot of talk about the role of lawyers in society. The reason I am bullish about what this enterprise is as adding value is this point. Lawyers are creative problem solvers and trusted counselors at our best. If we do that, whether it's on privacy policies or on wills or on business litigation or on regulation, we are going to have work to do. It's when you lose confidence that you're actually adding that value that you can be replaced by an automated will or someone else doing it a lot cheaper.
So I think we're preaching to the choir here. Everybody here believes in the value of employing somebody, an in-house counsel or a lawyer. Let's see source number 7. Therefore, he who has eyes in his head, and that's based on Koheles, should be more somebody who has foresight, should be more watchful to scrutinize the deeds of someone who he wishes to acquire as a friend, advisor, or appointee in his household, and he's watchful to scrutinize the food and drink. In other words, seeing the physical needs, we all need that. So we all need to, we all focused on making sure that we take care of our physical needs. He's saying that it's of higher importance to make sure that we have people and friends who can guide us and help us see past our blind spots.
And back to one of my core themes, play the long game. You building a reputation as a trusted advisor and counselor who listens to, cares about clients, and is an effective creative problem solver in whatever area you're working in, you build that reputation, people will then seek you out. It will serve you well.
And we have one more section that we'd like to bring up here before we stop for the break at 10 till. We're going to have a 10-minute break, and we're going to go straight into the second hour here. So one more point is, I think, the most important one, and it's already been raised here in certain ways, how to give advice. And some of the issues have been brought up here. Let's take a look at source number 8. The sages frame it like this. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, I will be surprised if there is anyone in this generation who knows how to rebuke correctly. Here's the challenge of rebuking correctly. The Talmud and Erechin says as follows, without embarrassing the person who is rebuking. It's about sensitivity. It's about removing those automatic defense mechanisms. If a person could have that art of putting the person at ease and removing those automatic defense mechanisms which will repel hard-to-hear advice, that's the art. And it's an old issue that it's delicate and it's a challenge to do it in the right way. But we are in need of doing it as best way as possible. Okay, and here's the key. The key is going to be source number 9. This is going to be from the Maimonides. And he says as follows. He shall speak to him calmly, employing soft language. Tell him that he does not speak to him save for his own good. Most important. When we are giving somebody else a hard-to-hear advice, a rebuke, the first thing a person needs to do is to communicate that it's not for our benefit. It's for our friend's benefit. It's for that person's best interest that we want to help turn them around. Pull close with the right and repel with the left. To turn the person around, it's not for my benefit.
So one point, and I loved your point about the technical expertise, and what you also said, and you picked up this too, the emotional connection, called emotional intelligence, is actually more important. So if I'm hiring someone, I'm hiring someone with a high EQ, I am more excited than high IQ per se. Why do I say that? Because from a client perspective, no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. So building a relationship where your client actually is willing to talk to you because they believe you care about them is essential. And you could be the smartest, best technical lawyer, but if your client doesn't want to talk to you for whatever reason, doesn't want to use you, you're not going to be of any value. Now, obviously, if you can be A-plus in both EQ and IQ, that's the best of all worlds. But if I have to choose between EQ and IQ, technical expertise and emotional intelligence, I'm going to choose emotional intelligence every time.
There's actually an excellent secular book called Crucial Conversations. I don't know if anybody's familiar with this. Crucial Conversations. Look this up. We actually felt it so valuable that we had an in-house training in our Kollel group for our educators to be able to to learn these techniques from a very well thought out approach, how to remove those difficult obstacles to having those conversations. And probably the most important piece of this is to know when not to give advice. There may be moments, even when we're in contractual requirements to give advice, we may push that off. We need to be able to move things around. We may not have the luxury, but it's an important thing to keep in tune to this. There are times when not to give advice. And take a look at source number 10. Just as it is a mitzvah to say what will be heeded, so too it's a mitzvah to say what will not be heeded. I'm sorry, I'm translating from Hebrew in my head. Kishem shemitzvah loyma davar nishma. Just like it's important to say something that will be heard and accepted. And it is also a mitzvah. It's important to know that you should not say something that will be repelled. The person will react in a way that will get him to do something in spite and do it anyway. So that's a mitzvah not to say. That's the time not, to live and let live. And there's maybe you may be legally required to do it. You may not have that luxury, but if you can afford to create that relationship first, and this comes back to what you were saying, and really comes back to something in this week's Torah portion, where our forefather Jacob meets the shepherds at the well, and he says to them, Achai, my brothers, what are you doing here? And isn't it time to feed the flocks? They're all sitting around, you know, taking a smoke or something like that. So why aren't you working, you guys? So the question is, why does it say Achai, my brothers? What is that? They're not brothers. These are some strange shepherds he's finding out by a well. And the commentaries say that he was creating a rapport, a relationship. Before you tell somebody, hey, you guys, why are you slacking off? The owner's expecting you to feed the flock, to water the sheep, you know? Before you do that, Achai, my brothers, create that relationship. So I think that the challenge is sometimes we're constrained with time, but if you do that, have that foresight, you know, like the Attorney General is saying, to maybe give some non-billable hours and to give that ability to make them Achai, make them my brothers, then we'll be able to actually truly give that heart to hear crucial conversations, and be able to pull close with the right and to turn people around to get them to where they are able to see their blind spots.
Can we thank Rabbi Schwab for all his leadership and good job?
Thank you, Phil. Thank you.